Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 256, and we're going to talk about 10 unusual vehicles that you can use for van life. Oh, no, we're not talking about like rare vans or anything. We're going to go weird. We're also going to talk about the Osoyoos Desert in British Columbia. Yes, Canada has a desert. We're going to dive deep into MC4 connectors, and we're going to take a look at fire blankets, which maybe will put out a fire. We will talk about that. Hey, folks, everything's weird. I'm going to keep saying that until things aren't weird, and that might never happen. Buying a vehicle right now is weird, and buying a new vehicle is weird, and that makes pressure on the used vehicles and blah, blah, blah. And I'm always talking about how in the U.S. we only have 3 basic vans that you can get. We've got the Sprinter, we've got the Transit, and we have the ProMaster, and that's it. Well, it's time to think outside the box and look at what other vehicles could you consider for van life. I mean, sure, there's RVs, okay, we talk about that a lot. There are SUVs, yep, absolutely. You have smart cars, yes, people have made campers out of smart cars. Box trucks are fairly common, but what about other stuff? Well, I've got a list here. It's 10 items. Let's go through it, and maybe something in here will spark an idea in your head, or maybe it will just all seem very silly. Whatever it is, we're going to do it, and we're committed now. Number one! This one you could have predicted. Ambulances! All right, so I put this at number one because obviously I talk about this a lot since I own an ambulance. But does an ambulance actually make a decent van life vehicle? And the answer is, it can. But you absolutely need to know a bunch of things going into it. The advantages. They come with built-in electrical systems. This is true. They're very, very sturdy. And depending on the type you get, they have a ton of storage. Lots and cabinets, internal and external cabinets. And that's all very good. So you're starting with a very solid base with a lot of furniture in it. All sounds great. However, the challenges are many. First off, forget about the living space. Let's talk about the engine. Ambulances are beat. They do very rugged duty, and often they will have incredibly high idle times. So you may find an ambulance with 150,000 miles on it, and you might think, oh, well, it's a diesel, it'll last forever, whatever. But if you look at the idle hours, they're huge, because basically these things never get turned off. It's not like they roll up to a scene and turn off the engine. They'll roll up to the scene and leave the engine running, because everything depends on the batteries and the engine power. For example, in my ambulance, the heat and air conditioning in the back, which are essential depending on what time of year it is, will only work if the engine's running. So I know for a fact that my van, every time it was in service, the engine was running. So the engine wear could be higher than it first appears. That's a fairly obvious challenge, and one that you can actually look at with an OBD2 port reader. The less obvious things are the electrical system, number one, which is going to be incredibly complex. It's so complex that it is often better to just rip it out, or at the very least, ignore it. You also have to remove a lot of the lights and a lot of the signs to make them legal. For example, you can't say ambulance, for one thing, because it's not an ambulance, and that's a protected word. Can't have any blue or red lights flashing, all that stuff. You know that. That stuff's also pretty easy. What you may not know is that removing the furniture is incredibly difficult. If you want to make any changes to any of the furniture, it's an incredible amount of work, and there's all kinds of videos on YouTube about people struggling to rip everything out of the back of the ambulance so they can start their build. And especially the hardest part, and anybody who owns an ambulance will tell you this, are the mounts for where the stretcher goes. Those mounts are so hard to remove that people go to extreme lengths with them. Mine, yeah, I'm not even going to tell you the story. But yes, it was a lot of work. Ambulances can be great camping vehicles, but you have to know what you're getting into. Another thing that's not obvious about them is if you get the typical kind of ambulance with the box in the back, you often can't stand up in that box. It really depends. Most of the boxes have a height of maybe 5.5 feet, so standing up in there is a challenge for taller folks. oddly, my Sprinter, I can stand up in the back. It's my Sprinter, even though it's a Type 2 ambulance, the one that's just a van without a box, it's taller. I can stand up in it. So know what you're getting into. But yeah, that can be a fairly cool and somewhat affordable sometimes entry into van life. But, oh, if you listen to my podcast for any time, you know there are stories. Number two, and I think this is a better option than an ambulance if you can find one, is a support vehicle, a disaster response vehicle, a police command post, or what is called a welfare van in the UK. We don't have these in the US. Let me just talk about welfare vans really quick. Welfare vans are so that people working outside would have a place to come in and have a snack, and maybe even use the bathroom. Some of them have bathrooms. It's just kind of a mobile break room, sort of. And those would absolutely make great campers. In the U.S., we don't really have those, but we do have command vehicles, such as what the police would use on a crime scene. Even fire departments have these sometimes. Disaster response units will often have these rigs. And what's really nice about them is that they don't get used very much. They're only used occasionally, and they don't have that many miles on them, and they're expertly maintained. One thing about fire department equipment is that it is up to the highest standards of maintenance, usually, because when the firefighters aren't on a call, they're maintaining the vehicle. So if you can find one of these, or even an ambulance that came from a fire department rather than an ambulance service, it's going to have a much better record of repair and maintenance. And you won't have all the extraneous stuff in a regular ambulance to deal with. For example, I had to remove suction pumps and the stretcher, and a whole bunch of related medical items that you wouldn't find in these vans. So those are hard to find. I see them most often at auctions rather than just for sale somewhere. But boy, if you can find one of those, especially like a retired Red Cross van, those are great. Number three, and people ask me this question all the time, and I've never seen anyone do it, a reefer. A reefer is a word with many meanings. In this case, we're talking about a refrigerated truck. So it's a truck. It's a rolling refrigerator, basically. And, you know, obviously fish companies and meat companies and dairy companies use these. And you might be thinking, well, air conditioning is a big problem. What if I just got a big air conditioner? And sure, you can do that. But you have to understand that the air conditioning basically only runs if the vehicle is running. There may be a generator that powers it, but Let's look at this problem differently. Would you want to turn a refrigerator into a tent? Because that's the problem you're looking at. So yes, it can work. And of course, they're super well insulated, but they're so well insulated that it can be a problem because the walls are going to be thick. You're going to have a lot less space inside, and ventilation is going to be a huge problem. There's basically no ventilation in a refrigerator truck, and to the extent that you could actually suffocate in there if you didn't take steps to make sure there was ventilation. Also, because of what they haul, if you find one that was a meat or fish company refrigerated truck, well, there have probably been times when that has defrosted back there and all those juices and stuff have sunk down. And yeah, okay, maybe it was a waterproof floor, but maybe it wasn't. And it could be on a hot summer day, some of those odors will reappear and suddenly your beautiful rig is a fish house and that may not be what you want. So I'm not a big fan of the idea of refrigerated trucks, but I can tell you that they're often very inexpensive. And if you found one that was a box-style refrigerated truck, on a good truck, you can actually remove those boxes fairly easily. I mean, you have to have something to pick the box up, but they just bolt on and off. And then you could find an old ambulance box or something simpler and put it on there, and then you'd be into something. So, again, this is outside the box thinking. I don't think a reefer is all that useful the way it is, but it might lead to something good. Number four, a tanker truck. Now hear me out, okay? Tanker truck is it's a truck that hauls oil or gasoline or water or whatever chemical, vegetable oil. If you think about that, it's just a big open space. And yeah, you could potentially install a door and put whatever you wanted in there, and it would be a really interesting and unique vehicle. Now, you wouldn't want to use one that was used for any kind of, you know, toxic chemical, gasoline or diesel or anything like that. Nothing like that. But if you could find one that carried some sort of food product like oil or water, even milk maybe, because you can wash it out. It's a stainless steel tank usually. Yeah, if you were very creative, you could turn that into a really interesting camper. Of course, then you're dealing with a big truck, usually, and you're going to have all the big truck problems. It's not going to get good gas mileage, you have to have it repaired at truck places, it's not going to be great for off-road, etc. But hey, if you're a creative person who's looking for something unique, you could do some interesting stuff with that, and it's all very, very, very heavy-duty. So maybe you are the one to do this successfully. Number five, military vehicles. Oh, there's so many military vehicles that when you see them, you're like, oh, I want that. It's a camper. I mean, there are Hummer ambulances that have a box in back. That would be interesting. And there are also a lot of all-terrain 6x6 and all kinds of vehicles like this. Yes, some of them can work. But this is the caveat for all of them. They're slow. They are not comfortable because the military does not care so much about your comfort. Veterans will agree with me here. And parts can be hard to find because these things are built not by normal manufacturers. Usually companies like Oshkosh or AM General or something like that. And, you know, they make other commercial vehicles too, like some fire engines and such. However, finding parts for them could be tricky. So these are ponderous vehicles. You can often get them for fairly little money, but they're not something you'd want to cross the country in. This would be something you'd want to have as kind of a specialty vehicle out west where you aren't going to travel very far, but maybe you wanted to take a larger vehicle off-road and have it survive. Also, the military has regular vehicles too. So if you are somebody who's tied into the military auction scene, they sell cars and trucks and vans and normal vehicles too, and you might find something there. But specifically, I'm referring to the, you know, the big go-to-war kind of vehicles that could also serve as campers. Now, keep in mind, the military itself does not sleep in vehicles, typically. That is not what they do. So none of these things are going to be ready to go. You're going to have to do a lot of work. Number six, and this is a totally viable option, a horse trailer. Not a utility trailer. No, a horse trailer. A trailer designed for horses. They're often not that expensive used, and unlike utility trailers, they are much stronger. They're much heavier built, because not only do they have to carry the weight of horses, they have to account for the fact that horses do things. They move around, they kick, they make messes, etc. They have to be strong. So horse trailers are really strong, and they're also a little bit more aerodynamic usually. They usually have a rounded roof and a little bit of rounding. It helps a little bit. But they're going to be solid metal in most cases, giving you a very, very stable platform to work on. Then how you tow them? Well, there's a couple different ways. There are bumper tow ones, which is, you know, what most people consider a normal trailer, but a lot of them are gooseneck, which is kind of halfway between a bumper tow and a fifth wheel. So you'd have to have the right kind of vehicle to tow them. Some of the really fancy ones actually have living quarters in them. It's not that hard to find a horse trailer that up front has a bed and a kitchen and a bathroom and an air conditioner for humans, and then kind of like stables in the back. One of those would be very easy to turn into some sort of camper, and you could use the back as a toy hauler, or you could just keep horses in it if that's your thing, because there are horse campgrounds all over the U.S. Number seven, and I know people have done this, double-decker and articulated buses. Okay, we know about schoolies. We know that that covers basically any kind of bus, from a shuttle bus at the airport to a massive touring coach. But there are also double-decker and articulated buses, even in the U.S. I mean, obviously, the U.K. is famous for double-decker buses, but there are some in the U.S. Can you turn one of these into a camper? Absolutely, and I know people have. You can search YouTube for this and you will find them. There was one family that was living in a double-decker, and they traveled the country in it, and they basically had their bedrooms upstairs, and they did the living quarters downstairs. Obviously, you get a ton of space, but you have all the problems of a double-decker. First off, of course, the thing is gigantically tall, so you're going to have to watch every bridge and every crossing, and there are many major cities, especially in the eastern U.S., that you will never see because this thing will not fit there. Also, weight. They're very, very heavy, so there are a lot of bridges you can't go over. So these things are not going to be all that useful for exploring the back roads, But if you were someone who only moved a few times a year, I mean, heck, that's a whole lot of space you can move. Now, articulated buses are different. They're not taller, they're longer. They're kind of like a bus towing a bus trailer with a bendy part in the middle. You see them in cities. Chicago has them for sure. And yeah, you could use one of these too, but you have to learn how to drive these. They're unusual vehicles. Like, backing up in them is a whole thing that you have to learn how to do. And they are not going to be geared for highways in most cases. Most articulated buses are for cities, and the gearing is designed for cities. So if you want to take them on the highway, you'd either be running at really high revs and using a lot of fuel, or you'd have to change the differential or something like that. They tend to be very inexpensive when they're used because there's only a few places that can use them. And if you were somebody who just wanted a vehicle that you could turn into like a tiny house, that you wanted it to be movable but not all that often, it might be something you could consider. Number 8, step vans. Now, we don't talk about them that much, and even though they're more common than most of the other things on this list, I wanted to put them in here because I think there's a lot of untapped potential in step vans. What is a step van, you might ask? Well, these days, delivery vans are changing, but back in the day, which to me, of course, is like the 80s, step vans were those heavy-duty metal vans that would deliver things like bread and newspapers, very boxy, not recognizable as like, oh, that's a Chevy or a Ford or whatever, because the bodies were built by companies like Grumman, who actually built the space shuttle. The heavy, heavy aluminum bodies, and very, very Spartan inside. But that's good. The fronts would have sliding doors, there'd be an engine, and that's it. Steering wheel, speedometer, a couple of little idiot lights, and heat, maybe. My dad drove one of these for years for the Boston Globe. He was a newspaper delivery guy at night. I would go to work with him and spend time in these things. And folks, there's nothing in these. But that's good because they're a blank slate. And the body will last forever. You may have to replace the engine, but that's not hard as far as engine replacements go. It's very easy to get to the engine. There's a doghouse, yes, but there's also a hood. You basically will drop the engine down, put a new engine in, but it'll take almost any truck engine you can just put in there. Manual transmission is common for the older ones, and I'm sure the new ones have automatics. But all that aside, step vans give you a really beautiful blank slate in the back of heavy-duty material. Square corners, you can build whatever you want, and it's smaller than a box truck. You get almost the same amount of space in there without the bulk of a box truck, and it's made for cities, so it'll drive around in cities. One issue that may not be obvious is, again, with the buses, the differential in these is often geared for cities. You may want to put in a different differential if you're going to do highway driving. Also, they're very, very loud, and again, not made for comfort. And a big challenge is, if you want air conditioning while you're driving, they typically do not come with engine air conditioning at all. You may be able to add that, but that's going to be a challenge. But wow, solid, solid vehicle, a blank slate that you could do whatever you want with, and they're fairly easy to find. Food trucks are often made out of these, and that's just because they're so durable. So don't overlook a step van if that meets your desires. Number 9, and you got to listen to the whole thing here, pop-up campers. Pop-up tent trailers, the cheapest, basically trailerable camper, but that's not what I'm talking about. Those campers are very, very inexpensive if you find an old one, especially if you find an old one with like ripped canvas, you know, a really old one where maybe the pop-up mechanism doesn't work. Those can be valuable to you because you can use that trailer to build your own camper. And that's just the base. You're getting the trailer and it has all the basics in it, except you're going to get rid of the tent and the top, and then you're going to build on that. It holds a fair amount of weight. It has electric and plumbing and all that in it. You'd have to be careful of how you did it. But a lot of people are buying these and replacing the tent with hard sides. You can make a hard side out of plywood or whatever, and then add your own roof, and you can have a very capable, a bit small, but a very capable, towable van, if you want to look at it that way, out of an old pop-up camper. And again, the big appeal here is that they're pretty inexpensive. So that is definitely a thing that you could do if you didn't have a big budget, but you had a lot of creativity and building skill. that might be an interesting way to go. And number 10, the last one, and I did this for fun because it sounds like something I would totally love to do, and I know at least one company has made at least one of these, a snow cat. What's a snow cat? Well, if you've ever seen the movie The Shining, the snow cat is the vehicle that would take people up to the lodge and back. It's basically a giant vehicle with treads designed for snow. In fact, you can only drive these in snow. That's it. If you drive them on anything else, you're going to damage the treads and whatever the treads are on. So, just the snow. But imagine this. If you had a situation where you had, say, a lot of hunting land or something like that, and you wanted a very comfortable way to travel to a beautiful spot for the winter and then stay in the vehicle, an old snow cat would be a hoot. I just think that would be so very, very cool. They do make snow cats that have a large enough cab that you can build everything into them. And of course, you've got challenges. I mean, it's the winter and stuff, but they almost all run on diesel, so you can have a diesel heater. I just think it would be super fun. They almost all have a lot of windows, so you'd have all kinds of view. One challenge that may not be obvious is, believe it or not, they typically aren't insulated at all because you're not in them unless they're driving. And when they're driving, they have all the heat in the world because that diesel engine is putting off a lot more heat than that cab needs. So I would love to do that. I don't have the resources or time or money or land or anything like that. But boy, that sounds very, very cool to me. So, hey, there's 10 unusual vehicles that you can do your van life in. Hopefully, some of you will say, I had never thought of that, and I'm going to give it a try. Even though most of you are probably thinking, I'll stick with my van. Thanks very much to Craig, because he bought me some diesel at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. And that keeps ads off the channel. There will be no ads in this podcast or any podcast for the foreseeable future as long as folks keep supporting me. And if you would like to help out, you may go to buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And buy me some diesel. And very special thanks to all of you who do this every single month. I absolutely appreciate it. Van Life News. Well, first piece of news here, and this news is actually going to go downhill. We're starting at a high, we're going to go to a low. But the high, at least for me, was I was asked to be a guest on the podcast Treasures of Our Town, which is a podcast with Josh and Craig, and they love geocaching and everything associated with geocaching. Munzee, all these games where you go visit places and try to find things, that's their thing. That's what their podcast is about. And they asked me to come on and talk about what to do in places that seem like they're boring, like this town has nothing in it. I don't agree with that. I believe every place has something interesting in it, and they gave me 3 places that seemed boring and challenged me to find interesting things to do in all those 3 places, and I think I did. And that's what the podcast is about. There's a link in the show notes, but the name of the podcast is Treasures of Our Town, and the episode is called The Boring Town Challenge. And if you become their Patreon, which I do recommend, supporting things like this is important. They don't have ads either, by the way. You will hear my methodology for how to find these interesting places and how anybody can do it. I'm not some, like, find the interesting stuff guru. I just have tools that I use, and you can too. But that is in the special section called The Golden Nuggets of Treasure of Our Town. So thank you to Craig and Josh for having me on the show. I had a great time. It kind of makes me wonder if I shouldn't try to be on some other podcast as a regular guest or something, because I actually like being a guest. So, hey, if you have a podcast and you want somebody strange like me on there, I'd be happy to be a guest. Next, this isn't really van life news, but it's been popping up and a lot of people have been talking about it, so I'm just going to address it here. The Camping World flag controversy. So in South Carolina, there's a Camping World. Now, if you're not familiar with Camping World is a very large chain of RV dealerships in the United States, probably the largest. I'm pretty sure they're the largest. And they are always having some controversy. They have a terrible reputation amongst some people for not providing proper support and being rude to customers and things like that. And yet other people will explain just how wonderful they are and everything went well. So I don't know, they're one of these places that seems to always be in the news about something. This time they're in the news because this one Camping World, which is next to a highway, next to an interstate, has a massive U.S. flag. This flag is gigantic. How big? Well, Camping Worlds are famous for their big flags, but this flag is 3,200 square feet. I can put that in American terms for you. It's the size of a football field. Imagine an entire football field waving in the air. Okay, very patriotic of you. I get it. The pole itself is 130 feet tall. That's as tall as a 13-story building. And it's up there waving away. And apparently people want it to come down. And the reason they want it to come down is because it's illegal. It's not illegal to fly a U.S. flag. It's not illegal to fly a large U.S. flag. It is illegal to fly a flag that big. There are restrictions on the size of flag you can fly in this part of South Carolina. And the reason is that they're loud. Flags can be super loud, and that can be a nuisance. And also, there is some danger there because you have this thing up in the air that's very heavy and is subject to the weather. Strong winds could affect this thing, obviously. And if anything happens, this thing's going to come down. Well, what if it covered the interstate? Or what if it landed in traffic or hit somebody? There's a lot of issues with it. So the town has ordinances, and this Camping World is flaunting them by having this massive flag up there. The owner has said that flag will never come down. He is completely defying the order to take it down. And remember, the order is not to take it down. The order is to replace it with a flag that meets the standards. Well, the end of the story is, instead of taking the flag down, they shut down that Camping World location. That was the solution. I'll have a link in the show notes and you can read more about it. But I am wondering if in this current marketplace where RV sales are way down because everyone's uncertain about the future and people bought a lot of RVs during COVID and they're just not buying as many now, I wonder if Camping World just needed to kind of get rid of a location and wanted to get some publicity for it, and they wanted to get publicity for being so patriotic that we're going to defy the government, which if you think about it, is a little strange. But anyway, that's the Camping World thing, and there's a link in the show notes if you would like to read about that. And if you're in South Carolina, sorry, there's one less Camping World. And this last thing, okay. You may remember Gabby Petito, and she was a young woman who was murdered by her boyfriend. They happened to live in a van, or they were traveling the country in a van, in a Ford Transit Connect, one of the old style, the ones I liked. And now there's a documentary about it. Horrible, horrible story, and I've commented on the podcast in the past that I didn't want to talk about it a lot because it's not a van life story. It's a murder story. It's you know, the fact that they were traveling in a van was incidental to the fact that this was a troubled relationship that ended tragically. Well, there's another one of these, and it's so many people have brought this to my attention that I feel like I have to address it. So, and again, I'm going to shout out to Darren and Karen, the rhyming duo, who have given me a lot of news lately. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. I don't do everything they give me, but some of the stuff I do, and that's helpful. So this is the Vermont van life murder. I'm not going to get too much into it, but basically a couple are traveling, and they go to Vermont, into oddly Bolton, Vermont, which is right next to Richmond, Vermont, where I lived. I'm very, very familiar with Bolton. And I know right where this happened. It was at the base of the ski resort there. There's a little lodge area. They don't have a lodge, but there's a little area down there that has, like, condos and stuff. And, well, that's where it happened, and it's pretty gruesome and horrible. I mean, all murders are, but this one, he killed her and stuffed her in the bathroom of the van. I mean, imagine that. And this van was actually a schoolie. It was, like, an airport shuttle they'd converted. It looked like a very nice build. Anyway, see, I'm more interested in the van than the murder, which, you know, that's maybe not good, but Bottom line is, the guy is now in trial. He claimed self-defense, and there's this whole issue. And of course, van life is going to get dragged into this because it happened in a van. Again, this has nothing to do with van life. Van life does not lead people to murder people. People lead people to murder people, and that's a whole other phenomenon. And you know how many true crime podcasts there are? You don't need me to talk about this anymore. But there is a link in the show notes from Court TV if you would like to track this one down. TikTok! Tech Talk, solar panels. Solar panels almost always come with MC4 connectors. Those are those funny little prongy things. There's a male and a female one. They sometimes have an orange ring, and they're waterproof connectors. MC4 actually stands for multi-contact, which was apparently the name of the company that invented them. And 4 is the size. They're 4-millimeter connectors. So they are IP67 rated for rain, which is very good. That's a high rating. That means they can be outside and it's not a problem. I use them all over the place. There are very frequently Y connectors. You can hook panels together. They're good. But I have a message for you about MC4 connectors, and that is, it is fine to cut them off. No, I'm serious. Every connector you have in your cable is a weak point. And while it's nice to be able to just plug things in, if you're looking for efficiency, if you're looking for the fewer number of points of failure in your system, it actually makes a lot more sense to get rid of the MC4 connectors and just run the wire you need. I have done this and it works fine. I will explain. In my NV200, I had 200 watts of solar on the roof, two 100 watt rigid panels, very basic. I think they were from Rich Solar. They worked fine. But the connectors, they were the MC4 connectors, but I was like, what? This is all this big, thick thing. I got to drill a big hole and all this. And I opened the junction box on the solar panels and unscrewed where the MC4 connectors were, the cables with the MC4 connectors were screwed in, and I took them out. And then I just made my own 10 AWG, average wire gauge, fairly thick cables, screwed them in with terminals that I added, and then those cables went straight to the solar controller with a fuse on the positive side. Even though some people say you don't need that, I like fuses, I put them in wherever I can. By doing that, I had exactly the right length of cable. I didn't have any connectors that could fail. And it wasn't that hard. I also made a smaller hole in the roof of my van because my cables were thinner. My cables actually were higher quality than the ones that come with solar panels. And so my message to you is simply, just because there are MC4 connectors on there doesn't mean you have to keep them. If there's something better, go ahead and cut them off. And do you know what? You can always add them back. MC4 connectors are something you can add back. You might need to do a little bit of soldering, but it's not a lot of work. So, yeah, MC4 connectors are great. I like them. But when I'm going to build out my truck this summer, I hope, I'm probably going to cut them off of the solar panels I'm using because I think I'm going to be powering a Jackery. But also, never mind, remember this. Nearly every solar controller in the world just has terminals where you either put in bare wires or you put in a crimped terminal connector. Unless you're going to get an adapter, don't. Just cut them off. It is okay to cut wires, folks. I know folks new to this stuff are terrified at the thought of cutting a wire. It's like cutting an umbilical cord or something, but yeah, you got to do that too. Product review. Susan in Canada, thank you for the suggestion, Susan, asked me to take a look at fire blankets. Now, you may have seen ads for these on, you know, all the TikToks and Reels and Instagrams and all that. These ads are everywhere for me, and I know because I do the podcast, I get a lot of van life stuff. But fire blankets are very simply blankets that you put over a fire to put the fire out. They're smothering blankets. This is not a new thing. These have existed for a long time. What's new is that they're being promoted and sold in packs and in these bags that you hang up, and then there's one cord and you pull the cord and then you have the blanket in your hand and you put it over the fire. And so the question is, are these of any use in van life? And the answer is yes and however. And so the way these work is you would hang them up somewhere where you're likely to have a fire, and that's usually the kitchen. So I put one in the kitchen of my condo, and I put it in a place where I know where it is and it's easy to get to. And if there is a stove fire, like let's say I leave a pan on the stove and the grease gets too hot or whatever and flames start coming out, I know I can grab this thing and put it over the entire stove and it'll put out those flames right away. And it's a lot less messy than using the fire extinguisher that is also right there. In fact, I have the fire blanket on one side of the kitchen and the fire extinguisher on the other. I think that's a perfect use for these fire blankets. But I want you to note that I also have a fire extinguisher. The most important takeaway here is that these fire blankets are not substitutes for fire extinguishers. There are limited ways in which these will work. Now, imagine you're in a van, and you have the same situation. You grab the fire blanket, but things are weird in a van. It might be too cramped in there to unfold this thing properly, because these things are folded up to be about 10 inches by 10 inches, or maybe even 8 inches by 8 inches. So you have to unfold it before you can use it, and if you're cramped in a van, that might be difficult. Also, they're only good for flat fires. So a stovetop is a perfect example. You have a pan that's on fire, it's nice and flat, you put the blanket on it, that's great. But if you have a fire that has engulfed a cabinet or something, well, you might not be able to get the blanket to cover it completely. This isn't something like that you push up against the fire. The point is that you want to cover it with the blanket to remove the oxygen. And depending on the shape of the object that's on fire, the blanket might not actually do it. So I think they're of less use in a van. That said, they're not very expensive. So I will put a link in the show notes, and I will recommend them as long as you understand that they are not a replacement for fire extinguishers. That's crucial. Also, if you do have one of these, you have to practice with it. You have to go through the motions of fire, and then go to where it is, take it out of its package, unfurl it, and then throw it on whatever you're pretending is on fire. It seems silly, but that is what will create in you the muscle memory that you need when there is a crisis. You don't want to have to think. You want to know what to do. So you have to do that. Another thing is that they're, you know, it's this big red bag. So where are you going to hang it? It's got to be somewhere that's always accessible. Ideally, it would be on the outside of a cabinet where you can see it all the time, but then you can see it all the time and it's kind of ugly. So maybe on the inside of a cabinet, but wherever you put it, it's got to be somewhere that's very, very easily accessible. And honestly, it'd be best if it were accessible from the outside too. So if you had a van with a sliding door, it would make a lot of sense to have it somewhere where you could reach in and grab it from the outside, but also reach it from the inside. Because sure, things happen outside too. Maybe there's a grass fire or something and you want to quickly put it out. This would be great for that. But never, 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 never forget that the fire's the problem. The blanket might be a solution, but your fire extinguisher is your best bet. And also remember 911, because if the blanket doesn't work and the fire extinguisher looks like it may not work, you might want to call 911 right away. And a lot of people tell you to call 911 first. It's tricky, though, because while you're talking to 911, the fire's growing, etc., etc. So this is yet another tool to help fight fires, but it cannot be your only tool. There are dozens and dozens of brands. The link is the ones I bought. They're fine. So I can tell you that these are fine. They're decent enough quality. Can they be reused? Maybe, but I wouldn't bother. I mean, if you're going to cover a fire with one of these, it's going to get all filthy and disgusting, and then you're going to fold it back up and put it in the bag and then keep it in your van. Your van's going to smell like fire forever. So I would say they're one-time use, but don't let that stop you from using them. Buy a four-pack if you're worried about it. Hang one up and use it, and then just replace it with a fresh one, because this is not a time to be frugal. Putting out the fire is what matters. Tales from the road. Back in the day, I moved to Utah from Massachusetts. I was young. I moved there with my girlfriend. We ended up getting married in Utah. And we moved with a bunch of friends, and it was great. We had a blast. Utah at the time, and this is 1988 or so, was a very affordable place to live. But I had an RV at the time. I had, which would be considered a van by today's standards, I had a Mini Cruiser, which was a 1983 Toyota truck, which very small, nothing compared to today's Toyota trucks, with an RV on the back. It looked like a Class C, and it was fully self-contained. It had a bathroom and a shower and a holding tank and, you know, everything. And it was great, and I loved it. And it was my daily driver. And one of the first jobs I got in Utah was at Ardell Brown RV, which does not exist anymore. This was in Sandy, Utah. It was right by an old Pony Express station, believe it or not, and it was just over the hill from where Footloose was filmed in Lehi, Utah. My time at Ardell Brown started off a little strange, and it ended a little strange. I went in there. This was back in the days when you found ads in the newspaper, and I called them up and they said, come in for an interview. And I went in with my resume that had all, you know, all these jobs that I'd had, but nothing specifically related to working on RVs. And the job I was applying for was lot boy, which is the lowest job you can have at an RV dealer. Basically, you'd clean and prep the RVs and do all that kind of stuff. And the guy said, I've got 100 applications on my desk. Why should I hire you? And I said, because this isn't just a job to me. I love RVs. I drive an RV all day, every day. It is my only vehicle. And I just love RVs. I know how they work. And I'm going to be able to do some of these things with more heart and more interest than the other people you have. And apparently that sold them because they hired me. And I was one of a couple of lot boys. And we spent our days cleaning and prepping RVs. Whether a used one came in that was a trade-in, I would go in and clean it and make sure everything worked and put it away. Or if there was a new one going out, I would make sure all the systems worked and polish it and everything. And there were just a number of strange things that happened while we were there. One of them isn't that strange, but the way we moved RVs around wasn't with a truck or anything. We had an airport tug. So tugs, if you look out in the airport, you know, if you're in an airplane waiting to take off and you look out the window, there are these cute little cars that pull the baggage carts around. Those are called tugs. That's the name of the company that makes them. And we had one, and I got to drive it around. Very unusual vehicle, especially because it doesn't have a suspension. Like, there literally is no suspension on these vehicles because on a runway or an airport tarmac, you don't need one because it's completely smooth. But our lot wasn't completely smooth. It was a dirt lot with maybe 40 RVs on it. And man, you took a beating driving that thing around. But yeah, I towed trailers around all the time with it. I learned a lot about backing up trailers and stuff. And for fifth wheels, there was a fifth wheel hitch mounted on the hood of the tug. So you just pull right up to the fifth wheel and then back it out. It was interesting. It was a good solution. And I learned a lot about how to move RVs around with that. And then one day, the sky turned yellow. And some of the people who were more familiar with the area said, uh-oh, here we go. We got to shut everything down. I was like, well, what's going on? It's a dust storm coming. It was actually a haboob. That is the official term for this. Massive, massive dust storm coming from the south. The sky turned yellow, and then this cloud enveloped the entire area. This thing had to be miles wide. You couldn't see anything. Just an amazing phenomenon that I've never witnessed since. But that was a thing that we needed to close everything up because everything was going to get filled with dirt and dust. And people there seemed to like me because I actually did care about this stuff. You know, when I got a used RV that I had to take care of and brought it in, I always made sure everything worked. I would repair everything. And sometimes that got me in trouble because I'd spend a lot of time fixing something and they would be like, it's not worth it. They, you know, but I wanted to make it perfect. And I learned all about all these different systems. I mean, we sold Winnebago and Itasca and Jayco. But I learned a lot about every make of RV because of all the used ones that were brought in. And then things got weird in a bad way. They promoted me. Being promoted, if you've watched Star Trek, being promoted is often a bad thing. Yeah, this was a bad thing for me. They promoted me to run the store, from being a lot boy to running the store, and didn't give me any training or anything really. They just said, here, run the store. And it was a pretty good-sized store, and I learned a lot about merchandising and inventory and all this stuff, but I wasn't really very good at it because I'm not really good at asking people for money. It's a problem I have. I still have it. It's a situation I'm going to run into this week, in fact. I don't like it, and often people would come in and try to make deals, and I would basically give them whatever they wanted, which was in direct conflict with what the dealership wanted. And the final straw was, I was supposed to get a raise for working in the store, and after doing it for a month, my paycheck came, because they only paid monthly at this place. You could do a draw. You could get a loan on your paycheck after 2 weeks, but after the end of the month is when you got paid. And they didn't give me my raise. I had done the job at the same rate as a lot boy and didn't get my raise, and that infuriated me. And so I went to lunch in my RV, and I never came back. I just drove off into the sunset, and that was that. I'm not sure if I'm proud of doing that or not, but it's what I did. And it ended that adventure and led to many other adventures. And it's 30-something years ago now. It's just a story at this point. A place to visit. Yes, there's a desert in Canada. I mean, I've talked about the desert in Maine before. This is a totally different phenomenon. The desert in Canada is called Osoyoos. I hope I'm saying that correctly. It's O-S-O-Y-O-O-S. Osoyoos. The Osoyoos Desert is in British Columbia, and it's called Canada's only desert. But it's, well, the definition of desert is basically all based on rainfall. And this place gets 12 inches of rain a year, which is too much for it to technically be a desert. But if you're there, you're going to think it's a desert. Technically, it's a semi-arid shrubland. It's nothing like the Sahara in that regard. But it's very cool. First off, it's hot. And since it's in Canada, I'll use Celsius. It gets over 40 degrees Celsius in the summer, which is 104 in Fahrenheit, and that's pretty darn hot. It's not a temperature you associate with Canada very often. It also has weird plants and animals that you can't find anywhere else in Canada, like burrowing owls. You can find them there. And it has sand dunes and cacti and rattlesnakes. I mean, this is not what you think of when you think of Canada. But it is definitely a place that you can see in British Columbia, and I would love to see it. I have not been there. There's also, and I know I'm going to pronounce this wrong, the Nikmip Desert Cultural Center. And Nikmip is spelled N-K apostrophe M-I-P. It is run by the Osoyoos Indian Band, and you can learn a lot about the indigenous culture there, and they have trails and such, because people have lived there a whole lot longer than just the Europeans. Also, they spell center R-E. That's a Canadian thing, so I'm told. It looks like a really interesting place, and if you're looking for someplace unusual to visit in Canada this summer, this might be a place to take a look at. Lots of camping in the area, and I would imagine they do a lot of Hollywood filming there too, because an awful lot of these Westerns and such that are take place in the American West, well, are actually in the North American West of Canada, and I'll bet that happens here too. So I have a link in the show notes at destinationosoyoos.com where you can learn more about it, but I thought that was a kind of a cool little thing to find and not what you'd expect in Canada. Resource recommendation. So I keep talking about the iOverlander thing. So I thought, well, everything's going AI these days. What if we asked AI? So let's give it a shot.
Hey, Jeff.
I'm looking for a place where I can park my van overnight in Key West, Florida. Do you have any suggestions for me?
For overnight van parking in Key West, it's a bit tricky since the city has strict rules against overnight parking in many areas. Some folks recommend using boat ramps or parking areas near fishing bridges along Highway 1. But it's crucial to move your van each night to avoid any issues. If you'd rather play it safe, check out local campgrounds like Boyd's on Stock Island, or seek advice from Van Life Forums for the most recent intel. Safe travels, man.
Okay, that's pretty good advice. How about, say, Las Vegas, Nevada? Are there any safe places to park a van there at night?
In Las Vegas, a few options for overnight van parking include the Bellagio Parking Garage, which offers safe and secure parking for guests, and the Strat Hotel and Casino, which has an oversized parking lot where RVs and vans frequently park overnight. Another common spot is the Walmart Supercenter on Boulder Highway, but it's best to confirm with the store manager about their overnight policy. These spots can vary in availability and policy, so it's wise to call ahead and confirm.
Okay, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So, is that a viable solution? I mean, it's obviously not the same thing, but at the very least, it came up with some ideas, and it would give you a starting point for some research. For example, of these two examples here, I know a little bit more about than the AI. I know that it's illegal in Key West to sleep in your vehicle overnight, regardless of anything. It doesn't matter if you're allowed to park there or not. You're not allowed to sleep in your vehicle, unless you're in a designated campground. So, anything you do in Key West will be illicit. However, so what? You know, what are they going to do? They're going to knock on the window and they're going to ask you to move. Of course, the problem in Key West is where do you move to? Because you're like on an island. Vegas used to be kind of a van lifer's paradise. I mean, other than the heat, there used to be lots of free parking, and the suggestion of parking in a parking garage there is actually pretty good. And given that things are 24 hours, it wouldn't be that unusual to see people coming in and out of a van at 3 in the morning. And there's lots of restrooms at the casinos and stuff. However, Vegas has changed a lot, and now they charge for parking in many cases. So that would require some more research. The point is that as a resource, AI can do this for you. You can actually ask if there's a place to park near you, and it is going to search basically all the stuff and come up with some ideas. And no, you can't trust it. You can't trust anything AI says, because it is not a truth engine. It's basically a super glorified search engine in this regard. But since the search engines have gotten much harder to use lately, I think it's a useful resource. So the one I was using there is just Copilot. It's free. It's at bing.com/chat, or you can download the app. But any of them would be similar. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 256. If you'd like to get a hold of me for any reason, I am jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And at builttogo.com, you can find links to the Discord server and Facebook. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of Halson, who said, "Pause and let your gaze wander. The trees whisper, the wind dances, the land breathes. Know that all is ephemeral, and you are among the fortunate few to witness this fleeting beauty."